I'm Steve Martin. Our guest today is Darren Beachley. Darren has a great past and future in bluegrass. He has a new album coming out very soon. We only have one song from it, and that's the By Design. I'll play for you the one single that we have. It's New Ballard Branch. It's a great song. And then we're going to talk to Darren at length about the new album and all the control and the choices that he made on it. It's going to be fantastic. Even Eric Clapton songs. And then we're going to just talk a lot of memories. A lot of stuff happened in 2021. Sharing memories, trust me, Darren's are much better and much well-suited and grounded. His experience far exceeds mine. I so enjoyed chatting with him. I'll tell you this, was the second time that we actually talked at length. The first time was just sort of like to get to know each other, and it instantly worked. And you're going to enjoy hearing from Darren. This is his new song, New Ballard Branch. You just heard a great new tune, New Ballard Branch, from my guest today, Darren Beachley, first-time guest. Darren, how are you?
Doing well, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing just fine, man. Thanks so much for being available. Darren, as I say, is a first-timer. There's a lot of bluegrass history in Darren. I want to talk a little bit about this song that we just played, because it's the new one, the New Ballard Branch. Great song. Has a great story to it. Talk to me a little bit about that. We're going to talk about the album coming up,
well,
and I want you to talk about the musicians that you have on this.
Great. Yeah, that song actually came to me quite by accident. Kurt Vestal, who is on the recording, I was looking for another bluegrass song for the album, and he said, man, I got this song that I'll send it to you. So he sent it to me, and I heard it. I loved it. And I said, man, who wrote that? And, well, come to find out, it's Eli Johnston who wrote it. So he currently... was working with Doyle Lawson up till the end, and it's funny how there's so much of a Doyle Lawson connection.
Well, yeah,
this recording.
Yeah, and I've seen Eli. He was the bass. I've seen him. Yeah, okay.
Bass and banjo player. Eli was the last banjo player Doyle had. So anyhow, Kurt sent it to me. We recorded it, and I love singing this song. So when it came down time to do the harmonies on it, I sang the harmony the first time in the studio, and I thought, you know, it just doesn't feel good. So I had I called Mike Rogers, who is another Doyle Lawson alumni, and he's singing the tenor part on that, and Kurt is actually singing the baritone. Of course, we know Kurt Vestal also worked with Doyle in the 80s.
Right.
Scott Vestal's playing banjo on that, who also is another Doyle alumnus. On the mandolin, I've got Alan Bybee, who, of course, is, you know, he's great and so easy to work with. Clay Hess is on guitar. And I used Doyle's fiddle player as well. I used Stephen Birdwell, played the fiddle on the track. So there is a huge Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver connection. It's funny, we have like several different eras in this one recording, but you know, it's really funny. We all kind of speak the same language. I wonder where that came from.
Yeah, really. you mentioned Doyle. I know I've seen you when you played with. It's been a while, but. But you are a regular member with and traveling with Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver. Great show, great band. I know they have a lot of influence over you, and
yes.
Which is a good thing. And I also want to remind the listeners, that some people look at the radio when I'm doing this. That's what I meant. but the Legends of the Potomac, I remember them also.
Yeah, that was a band. I was with Doyle from 2005 to 2009. And, you know, as any... body knows that has worked or seen Doyle, his tour schedule is
murderous.
Really, really, yeah. It's very, and I had at the time, my children were very young, and my wife, you know, I have hats off to her every day for. I mean, she was Mr. Mom and Mr. Dad both while I was on the road with Doyle. I mean, I think the first year I was on the road with Doyle was like 200 some odd days, which is a lot of days.
Wow. He was a warrior,
right? And you know, so, you know, after a while, I think you get to a point where it's like, man, you know, I'd really like to eat dinner at my house every once in a while and not live out of a suitcase. And I got to doing some during the week jams with Mike Aldridge, who is one of my heroes when it came to music, and Tom Gray. You know, I grew up with those guys.
Yeah, they are legends. They're legends.
And that's kind of how the name just came about. The name was, you know, with Mike Aldridge and Tom Gray, and I had Norman Wright on the mandolin, and Mark Delaney on the banjo. So all those guys had been with the Country Gentlemen or the Seldom Scene.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, the whole thing was a play on words like Legends of the Fall. We wanted to use Legends of the Potomac. And, you know, a lot of folks, were a little bit taken back when we first named it. Like, well, who are these guys naming themselves legends? Well, I don't, you know, Mike Aldridge is definitely Larry the Legend at the time.
Yep.
Mike, that was his nickname. So, but they insisted on having my name out front of the band because I had just left Doyle. And so it worked out. It was a great band.
Really
so much
was.
Fun. And it was, you know, we worked. I mean, that band, we were together like 2.5-3 years, and we worked 85-90 days the first year I was out with them. And that's a lot of days for a part-time. We were a part-time band. It was a lot of days. And the only recording that we did was a takeoff on Patuxent Records, and it went to number 11 on Billboard. So I felt very good about what we did, and great material. Of course, those guys, you know, those guys had done it for so long. I just was kind of, yeah, you know, maybe give some tips here or there, but, you know, you just went along and went for the ride with those guys and let them do what they do. I mean, they created so much great music over the years. I just kind of was like, you do what you do, guys. I'm not going to tell you how to do anything.
Darren,
so, Darren's it was so been, much fun.
Oh, I imagine. Darren Beachley's been part of bluegrass for so long on that part, mostly in that, I would say, the East Coast, maybe. Darren, is that where you spent most of your time in that area that we're talking
about? Yeah, home is Point Rocks, Maryland, which is about 55 miles west of Washington, D.C., right along the Potomac River, and that's where Frederick County, Maryland, is where I was born and raised. I've never really called home anywhere else, and, you know, the 4 years I worked with Doyle, I traveled up and down 81 to meet the bus. I never moved, so it was, this is home, and it's always been home.
Good, good. Listen, it's a great new song, and you mentioned Clay Hess. I met Clay Hess a long, long, before he... He had won a guitar. I have to tell this story every time his name, because he's such a good guy. He had won a guitar playing contest, and he was working in a music store near where I live, and I was looking for a new banjo.
Nope.
So I go into this place, and it was in Covington. It's not even there anymore, in Covington, Kentucky. And I just walk in, and they just got a couple new banjos, and I was playing one. And so Clay gets a guitar off the wall. I don't know him at all. He gets a guitar off the wall. I just think he's working at the store. And so I'm just, like, focusing on playing, and he starts playing Tony Rice. And it's around what I'm playing, and I'm just like, I can't think of what I'm doing and listen to what he's doing, because he was so great. Nicest guy in the world. I went back in a couple times and sat and played with him a few times. And it was right after that that he got the call to the bigs. What I mean by that is that Ricky called down, Ricky Skaggs called to this music store, and it – Clay wasn't, this is his story, not mine, but it's such a fun, because I remember when it happened. He wasn't there anymore, and someone said, well, this is what happened. Ricky Skaggs calls the music store, and they hang up on him. And so, and Clay wasn't there, and he comes back, and they said, and so then Ricky calls again, and that's when Ricky Skaggs hired Clay, and he's such a good guy. He lives Eastern Ohio, a little bit further from me than you might think when you mention Ohio, since I'm Northern Kentucky, but he's just nearby. He's a great guy.
Well, my first interaction actually with Clay was at the Gettysburg Bluegrass Festival when he was with Ricky. He hadn't been with Ricky very long. And, of course, Brian Sutton had been with Ricky. And then I see this guy come on stage. I'm like, well, who's this cat?
Yeah.
You know, of course, you know, if he's on stage with Skaggs,
he's real.
He can play. Yep. He's going to bring it. And, man, he flat out brought it. And, you know, so that was my first meeting with Clay. And then just over the years, and it's not like we're, you know, we know each other a lot or call each other on the phone a lot, but, you know, we'll talk and shoot the breeze, a lot of stuff. We have some things in common, and we'll talk, but when it came down to time for a guitar player, I was like, I got to get Clay Hess on my
record. You know, it's funny because he and Scotty Vestal, too, as I pay attention to a lot of banjo players, are the most relaxed players. When you watch them, you think they're pretty much doing nothing. And Scotty Vestal has the most relaxed right hand I've ever seen on a banjo player. And you think, that's what I've been doing wrong. I haven't. And then you go home and you think, well, it's an amazing control, and he's got this great touch. And Clay, when I think of Clay, I think of the same thing. He's just so confined and so relaxed and so easy, and he's just going through, you know. So that's a great group to have around you.
Well, you know, the thing, I went down to Scott's studio. I did another song on this record that's going to be coming up. Forever Man, it's an Eric Clapton tune.
Oh yeah, sure.
And plays on it Scott Curtis, and we thought, man, you know what, let's bring Sam Bush in on this one. And we brought Sam in, so I went down to Scott's, you know, for Sam's part, because I had never worked in the studio with Sam, and I wanted to be there for that. And you know, Sam comes in, and he's just, man, he's all pro. He's just, you know, so laid back, you know, comes in and goes to the bathroom, just so laid back and just walks into the studio, gets tuned, and just kills it. I mean, just killed it. And he looks at me, he's like, well, what do you want me to play? I said, man, you're Sam Bush. What to play?
Just let me know when to get out of the way. You play what you want to play.
But it turned out great, and I'm really excited to hear that.
Well, good. Well, let's talk then about the song that we played at the beginning, the New Ballard Ranch. It's a single. It's on Turnberry Records. So so you've mentioned that Forever Man, which is the Eric Clapton tune.
Yeah.
Most people will know it will be a single soon. When will that be? Yeah. And let's talk about when the album might be available.
I'm hoping the album will be out, before summer gets here. I don't, labels go. A lot of times they want to send out a few singles. My relationship with Turnberry, I have to be honest with you, I really wasn't looking for a label. I had gotten back into it and built a studio here in my basement. My son is into engineering and doing things like that, so I got really lucky that he knows a lot of that. So we built a studio in the basement, and I cut some stuff. And I was talking to Rebecca Spear because we were going to be doing some dual dates together. Mm-hmm. I was going to work some shows with her, and she told me she was going to work with Turnberry as their one of their AR people or something along that line. I said, jokingly, are you guys looking for any artists? And she said, well, maybe. And I thought, well, maybe if they don't put too many handcuffs on me and try to bridle me and rope me in, and fence me in, I would be interested in doing a label thing because I really wanted to expand a little bit and do some different things that I hadn't done. And sure enough, Keith Barncastle and Daniel Roth and Rebecca talked to me, and they just kind of gave me free creative control to do whatever I want. I didn't have to have a band to tour with because I really wasn't interested in touring a lot. I was already working with Linda Lay and doing some things like that. So they kind of really just gave me free creative control. And they have some great ideas about how they want to go about releasing music, and it's new and fresh. And I feel like that's a real thing that needs to happen. We need to kind of – acoustic music in general needs to change the way it releases music sometimes, and they've got some great ideas. So that was my biggest reason for going with Turnberry, because they have some they're thinking outside the box, with 1 foot in but 1 foot out, and that was really my biggest reason for going with them.
If you're just tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass, first time, and I'm enjoying this so much. Darren and I spoke the other day, talking to Darren Beachley, and Darren's a veteran of all kinds of bluegrass over the years. I know I've seen him several times. I know I'm with Doyle. We talked the other day, Darren, just kind of getting a little bit ready for this, about this devastating year of 2021 and with the losses. And it doesn't compare to the world, but in the bluegrass world, it's a shattering year. And then at the very end of that, Doyle is retiring, but we talked a little bit about, for a banjo player, anybody in bluegrass, Bill Emerson and Sonny, and J.D. Crowe, all within 6 or 7 months. I mean, that just destroys that entire layer right below Earl.
Yeah, you kind of just talked about it right there. That just kind of dropped the bottom out of the banjo world.
Yeah.
I mean, talking about Emerson, Bill met me. I met Bill in about 1989. I was working with a band here out of southern Pennsylvania, and Bill had just taken over Webco Records, who they were recording for, and he had never met me. I'd never met him. I was playing dobro. The next thing I know, Bill's calling me, and I'm showing up at Navy band shows, or I'm showing up at this show for Bill. And Bill tried to get me in the Navy way back then. And, I had the haircut and everything, was ready to go, and just I couldn't do it. There was something that just wouldn't let me do it. And it just didn't work out for me. Some guys can do it. I just couldn't do it.
Did you ever see Bill outside of his Navy clothes? Did you ever see him dressed?
Yeah, sure.
He was dressed to the nines.
Always.
It was everything was buttoned and polished, just like he was still in his Navy dress.
Absolutely. Well, I did a recording after he left the Navy. I forget which one it was. I recorded a song called Linda Lou that Paul Williams used to sing when he was with Jimmy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I recorded that on one of his records and got to the studio. Here I come in a pair of jeans and a T-shirt. I'm relaxed. Bill's in a blazer and a button-down shirt. And, I could see my face in his shoes. And, he was there. He was there to work. And for him, that was a workout.
That was his outfit.
He was there to work.
I think if you woke him up at 3 in the morning, Bill would be dressed like that.
Pressed.
Yeah, well, he was ready to go. And, we talked, you mentioned Jimmy Martin. And I want to talk about you more, but, we had this discussion a little bit the other day. Bill wrote Theme Time. which he wrote for Jimmy Martin, and it was originally called String Time. And when he got it with Jimmy, it was called Theme Time because it was meant to be their song to get on and off the stage. And then it became great. Every banjo player has to play Theme Time. You know, it's one of his great classics. It's so driving, clear, clean, incredible timing. Yeah. But what a great guy. And
alluding to Emerson, that's why I alluded to him, is because Bill had Bill kind of took me under his wing in the D.C. area. I was nobody knew. I mean, I played with my parents and stuff like that. I was just a kid. I mean, I was in bars playing at 9 and 10, 11 years old. I probably saw things that no 9 or 10, 11-year-old kid should ever see in a bar, you know. I mean, but my dad, you know, bass player, and guess what? You're it. But, you know, I love the education. But Bill really took me under his wing and started introducing me to people like Tony Rice introducing me to people like that. And it really kind of got me, you know, you talked about going to the bigs. That kind of got me from the minors to the bigs. Mm. Bill really helped me a lot. And it was I never forgot that. And anytime when he called me to do that recording with him, he's like, well, I'm not charging you anything, Bill. If anybody owes anybody anything, I owe
that's
you.
And
I would do that with any of my heroes. You know, I those guys spent time and gave of themselves for me. I certainly would give back at any time. But Bill's special. He was really special. And for that matter, you know, Crow and you know, I got a Crow story. I can tell you that one. And I was in Old Forge, New York, playing with the Travelers at the time. And we were doing one of J.D.'s old songs. We were doing Journey's End that he had done with Doyle and Larry on the Model Church record. Well, I had no idea that J.D. was there until a friend of mine is in the front row, and he's pointing to the side stage, like where the entrance is to the stage. He keeps doing that to me, like, you know, this pointing thing. And I look over, and Crow's standing in that doorway. And I thought, oh, boy. You know, because you don't do someone else's material. It's not cool.
Not when they're on the wing.
Not when they're standing backstage. Right?
No.
That's a no-no. So I walk backstage, and I'm putting my guitar in the case, and I see Crow coming at me. And I thought, man, this is it. This is where he's going to blow my wig off. And he came up, and he said, you know, I don't know why we don't do more of that older stuff. And I turned around and he said, you did a really good job on that.
Oh,
and
nice.
It made me feel like,
oh, yeah, you're on
man,
top of the world.
This is great, you know. And I'll be honest with you. He went on stage. I stayed and watched their thing because this was the time that, you know, Phil Ledbetter and the New South had Robert Hale and that group. And
they were great. Grammy
they came off, Crow came off the stage. I waited for him, and we started talking. And J.D., apparently, I didn't know this, but, you know, the only experience I ever had with J.D. has been upbeat and positive. And we talked about why they did their harmony structures like that, and then he got so excited talking about, and I could see it in his eyes when he was talking about Earl Scruggs. He talked about Scruggs like I talked about him.
Wow.
And I could see that, man, this guy, you know, he's J.D. Crow, but you can see that Earl was his guy.
Oh, no question.
And he got his banjo out. He said, well, let me show you how Earl played this or that. And I'm thinking, J.D. Crow is giving me a banjo lesson. You know, I mean, I was watching him from 2 feet away, and it just, I'll never forget that night, and every time I saw him after that, it was always, you know, and J.D. was great for giving you a one-liner backstage or some kind of cutting up thing. He was great for that. He was the funniest man ever. You know, I'd come off stage with Doyle, he'd say stuff like, well, Darren, you sang flat, but your guitar playing was out of tune to make up for it, or something like that, you know. And it was always something that was just a great one-liner. With, you
those
know,
guys. I mean, that whole crew that we've listed, they were all just, they were a class. There will be people, I believe firmly, that will rise to that level and will be revered by the next level. But for you and I, guys like me and similarly situated, those guys are royalty, all of them. That were just royalty.
You know, I couldn't have bought and paid for the education I've gotten over the years around those guys. I could not have bought and paid for it. I've been so fortunate and so blessed to get to work with my heroes and visit with my heroes. And, you know, the guys, Bob and Sonny Osborne, the same thing.
Yeah,
you know, you know, I don't know. I remember before pre-Doyle, I had cut some stuff with Blue Circle Records for Tom T and Dixie Hall's label. And Tom T was having his artist in residence thing that Vince Gill was hosting at the Country Music Hall of Fame at the auditorium there.
Oh, yeah.
So they invited me, of course. and I'm going to do a psalm. So Pat Flynn from Newgrass Revival was the band leader. And, of course, I show up that day for sound check. And you know, now remember, I'm just a kid from Point Rocks, Maryland, who really hasn't done much other than regionally mid-Atlantic, up and down the East Coast a little bit. I get to Nashville, and this is the big leagues, you know. So I walk out on the stage to do my song, and I look around, and there's Don Rigsby, and there's Randy Coors, and there's Stuart Duncan, and there's Pat Flynn, and this is the one that took me. This is the one that really blew me away. I expected those guys, but Charlie McCoy was there with his harmonica.
Oh man!
And I mean, this is the cat's whisker of all these people.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, man, I do not belong here.
Yeah.
And so this show goes on. Eddie Stubbs is part of the show, which is a whole other thing mm-hmm. with my music relationship. But so I'm standing there side stage, and the next thing I know, I'm standing between Paul Williams and Bob Osborne. And I almost fainted. I was like, this really doesn't need to be happening to me. You know, these are two of my tenor singing idols. And they were as gracious and nice to me. And Bob Osborne has been, he's been so good to me through the years. It's one of those things I've learned a lot from him just by listening. You know, there's an old guy that told me one time, you got two ears and one mouth, figure out which one you're supposed to use more.
Well, you're right. You're right.
And I, you know, these guys are my heroes. And I just listened to Bob, and he really has always had good advice. When I was working for Dole, he said, son, you're singing in the high cotton now, you know, and things like that to me.
I was just going to say, you're standing in the high cotton when you talked about on stage, but you're exact same meaning, yeah.
Yeah, and he I watched him and Paul and Doyle and those guys out at the Southern Ohio thing do a Jimmy Martin tribute one night, and yep. I had to sweep the dirt off the bottom of my chin, and my jaw was on the floor all night. And these guys were, and at this point, they were older, and they were still killing.
Just turn the switch on. They're ready to go.
Oh, man. Yeah, the lights came on. It's like, okay.
Yep, they're ready. I'm going to tell you, when I'm talking to Darren Beach, I'm going to talk about the album some more because you talked about Control You Had and Forever Man. But I want one more short Bill Emerson story. If you've heard this before from Bill, he's been on the show a couple times, and I got to know him pretty well. One of the happiest, this is when he was traveling with Jimmy Martin, I believe, and they were sleeping on heads is what he calls it. They would they would drive from one back road to one expressway. They'd drive and they'd just sleep on each other's shoulders in the back.
Yep.
He said the best day they ever, the greatest day they remember having is when they invented Reichgarten. and he meant it, man. He wasn't kidding.
Oh,
he said,
yeah,
that was
man.
The greatest day ever. We could jump in the gas station restroom because you never could take a shower, so they could get right guard and they'd go out. And I thought, what's this going to be? He's leading up to this great moment of this great player, and the great moment he remembers from those days is when they invented right guard. I thought, man, that's about as true as you're going to get. I mean, that's how they were. And, you know, Sonny told stories about, you know, passing Earl, and Earl was shaving in a creek.
Yeah,
you know, shaving out of a helmet in the creek, and just they did it because they loved it.
Yeah, Sonny shared the story with me about Once More. We played in Richmond, New York. My band opened for the Osbournes, and we were backstage. And Sonny was one of the guys. If you got to know him, you got to know him, and he was sharing with me about the story about Once More and how they got out of the car. And it was freezing cold, but they got out of the car so they could sing this song just to make sure that they remembered how they were doing it because they had inverted the harmonies at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody else had done that yet. And he said, we just wanted to make sure. He said, but we would get out of the car, and it was freezing cold. And I just thought to myself, how many guys today would do that?
None. Well, I don't say that. I don't say that. But I mean, first of all, they wouldn't have to. But I'm sure there's some if they needed to. But yeah,
those guys were committed, and they were committed and to their craft, and just you know, when I sit and think about it, including myself, you know, I had to slow records down and things like that. And the younger generation, gosh, they have all these tools, and man, some of these guys are phenomenal players. I mean, I listen to them play, and I'm like, my gosh, you know, how do you do the things they're doing? And they've had the opportunity to really slow things down and see things. And there was no tablature growing up for us. There was none of those things. And you know that. You know, we're kind of the same age. But, you know, it's you know, they're, it's a different generation. And that I think that leads to why some of these guys are such great players, because they've had so many things that they can see things and do things. And it's great for the music.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. So. Yeah, you mentioned Sonny. Let me just say this. If Sonny was your friend, he was your friend. And that was it.
Absolutely.
And you could never, you would count, you could count on that for the rest of your life. So let's talk about Darren Beachley's new album. Do we have a title yet, Darren? Thanks so much for sharing those stories with me, by the way. I knew that would happen when we got on the air, but we talked the other day.
We could.
Thank you for that. So the title, do we have a title yet?
Yes, the title is called The Road Not Taken.
Okay.
And the reason it is that title is it actually comes from a Robert Frost poem, and it actually hit me from the last verse of that poem, how, you know, what if you did take a different route? What if you took the road that was less traveled? What would you have done? And I think this record kind of gives folks a little bit of look into what I would have done if I hadn't taken the route that I took with Doyle or this, that, and the other. I mean, certainly those principles apply. I just need to let everybody know, once you've been with Doyle, the principles always apply.
Yeah.
You never... Yeah. They are...
That's your guidepost.
It's your DNA.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's your DNA.
Yeah,
I remember, and not to get off the path about the record, but I remember when I first left Doyle, we were in the studio cutting a Legends record, and I kept thinking to myself, well, I wonder, you know, if Doyle's going to want me to... And I thought, wait a minute, I'm not there anymore. And that was 6 months after I was gone.
Yeah.
So I still had that in my DNA, and I think that it gets grained in so much that, you know, and it's not a bad thing.
No, it's a great thing. It's a great thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I don't think that there's anybody that has ever been through that school, and I call it a school because it is.
It is.
That's ever been through there that can't say they didn't leave there better as a musician and better as a human being.
Yeah.
If they do, I think they'd really have to look at themselves a little bit more,
because
I don't know anybody that would do that.
But a lot of good ones come out of there. Listen,
So
we know from this much, Darren, that if you have control of as you said, you mentioned that went to Turnberry and you had control to do.
Yeah.
If you're picking Forever Man, you must have pretty much control on the selections, because I've never heard that done with in a bluegrass setting. I just never have.
Well,
so you must have had some good choices available to you.
I did, and the best part about that was that some of these songs are songs that I've had for 10 years and just really didn't have a vehicle to do much with them. And there's a John Pennell song, Pictures I Still Carry, that's a little more country than it is bluegrassy. I've got a Cat and Nancy Griffith song on there.
Oh, what do you have?
Listen to the Radio.
Oh, I loved her. I loved her so much.
I love stuff. She was great. And a lot of her stuff really converts over really well.
Yeah.
I've got another, let's see, I've got two Rick Bartley songs on there. I don't know if you know Rick.
I don't know him that well.
Yeah, Rick is Shane's brother. Of course, Shane and I traveled Beat the Roads together quite a bit over the years. Two really great bluegrass songs that, one of them I really feel like, and here we go again, you know, that Quicksilver thing. I think Memories of My Younger Days, I think I sent it to Jamie Daly, and he said, man, that sounds like the original Quicksilver to me. I mean, you know, of course, I got Scott and Kurt and myself and Alan, and it's great. I mean, it's just, and it really wasn't what I was going after, but when you have those guys in the band, it's kind of hard not to get that sound, you know. And but it sounds great. Harmonies are good on that. I did do a song that from a guy out in Colorado that is singing on it. I did some of these songs. I'm not even singing lead on. I have Rebecca Spear singing lead on a song.
Mm-hmm.
I have Christy Reed. She's Christy Shaver now, Lou's ex-wife.
Yeah.
She came in. I've always enjoyed her voice, and I had her do a song from The Green Cards. I don't know if anybody remembers The Green Cards.
I do. Kim Warner just moved back to Australia, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Carol, I knew Carol when I met them in Telluride 1 year, and just was eat up with their music. I love what they did. I thought they were the coolest thing. And so she did Ghost of Who We Were, Christy did on this record, and we really did more of a... I'll just let it speak for itself. I think she absolutely sang the fire out of it.
Yeah.
And I think she, you know, And then I had Rebecca Spears sing. Kim and Jerry Sally wrote a song called Shining in the Dark, and I had Rebecca sing that.
Yeah.
So we've got some cool stuff, and I've got an Irish flavored thing on there with a, you know, penny whistle and some fiddles and some stuff on.
This is great.
So there's something for everybody on this record a little bit, actually.
When you and that sounds great. And here's what I want: when the full thing comes, I want to bring you back, and we'll go in. I tested your memory there, but when the full thing drops, we'll talk again and go through some new things that have come out of it. But here's great. The funny thing, though. As you mentioned, these songs that are taken from genres that aren't always recognizable. Right. The New South, the first J.D. Crow and the New South album, they had songs from all over the place, which are now standards. Yeah. I mean, so that's the thing. It's like now that is, you know, when it first came out, I remember it's like some of their playing was great, obviously, but some of their songs people couldn't figure out why they were doing those things. Well, now they're absolute.
They're stalwarts. I mean, that's your playlist.
That's part
of bluegrass DNA now.
That's right.
I mean,
that's
you know, it's, and I think, you know, growing up Seldom Seen, and growing up Quicksilver, and growing up J.D. Crow, the Osbournes, and listening to the and even the Flat and Scruggs stuff that they did, they weren't doing dyed in the wool stuff that was right down the middle bluegrass stuff, and they were looking for other things to broaden the music. And Doyle always told me this, that in order for this music to survive, it has to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And I've taken that to heart. And while I love to go out here and just absolutely just bury some bluegrass
right down the middle,
but guess what?
Yeah.
I also love to entertain and bring a new audience into our bluegrass, because I thought Tony Rice did that really well. I thought Tony was good for doing his thing and actually bringing folks to the bluegrass field by doing his thing. Because his jazz audience would follow him, or whatever they called that. They followed him. And if he was doing bluegrass, and I think he brought a lot of people into bluegrass, and probably vice versa.
I think both ways. I watched him for both of those components. We talk about bringing in music. One more quick, and I'm going to let you go. But Bill Emerson, people may or may not know this. Fox on the Run, one of the absolute standards. He heard the radio version by Manfred Mann, who did it originally. Bill used to keep a recorder, and he recorded it off the radio, and he goes to and says, "Guys, I think we can do this song, and look where it is now." That was a rock and roll song from a British band.
Yeah, and actually the funny part about that, just to show you the link that I had to early DC bluegrass with Bill and Cliff Waldron and Mike Aldridge, my Uncle Bill Poffenberger, he played the fiddle on all that stuff.
Oh, did he? Okay.
Yeah, he played the fiddle with Emerson Waldron. He played the fiddle with Cliff Waldron, and then he was with Del McCurry. So I kind of got to see a lot of that stuff growing up with Uncle Bill, you know, some of it. But then he was one that he traveled, and he got tired of traveling too. It's funny how outside influences, if you can. And my son actually was the one, Forever Man, when we started listening for songs, he said, "Dad, you really need to do Forever Man." And I'm like, "Man, I don't know if it'll work." And we just fooled with it enough. I sent it to Clay, and I said, "What do you think?" And he's like, "Yeah, man, it'll work." So we made it work. And Clay was the guy who, he put the first guitar track, he put the first track down on it. And also about this recording is really odd. It's the first time I've ever recorded this way, where I record my stuff in my studio and I send it to Clay.
Oh, yeah.
And then Clay sends it back to me, and then I send it to Alan. And it was really weird. The only time that we were ever in the studio together was at Scott's place the one time. And it was really odd to record a record like that, but it turned out wonderfully. And I thought, man, how far have we come?
Isn't that weird?
To be able to do this? How far have we come?
Yeah.
Because I remember the days that, you know, I remember splicing tape. I don't think I remember doing that. That's on this record. I remember splicing tape to put two tracks together, you know. It's come a long way,
and it's not going back. It's not going to turn back. There will still be those parts, but the new parts are going to be incorporated. Even the live, even the stuff on whether it's Facebook or other social media, that's gotten so much better during COVID, where you can actually have a nice show. You can do that, where in the beginning it was somebody's phone and it was crooked, but now people have had time, and the artists and the engineers have figured it out. You can actually put on a great show doing that, so it's not going to go back in the box.
Well, music will never, as bad as COVID has been, and I work in a healthcare field, so I'm around it every day.
Right.
And as bad as it's been, it still, we've figured out a way to still put music out there to folks.
Yep.
and whether it be live or however, you know, I remember watching Flux Fridays with Jerry Douglas. You know, I couldn't wait for Friday.
Every Friday he'd be in this. Yeah,
I couldn't
was great.
Wait, man. I was like, 2 o'clock. Is it 2 o'clock yet? Yeah, I looked at the clock all day long at work, and then I'd turn it on. And Sam Bush, you know, watching Sam do his things. And those guys, I mean, and the quality was great, and the music was great. And they were so informal with their audience thing. It was almost like this. They were sitting in your living room, and I loved that part of it. And I think sometimes we lose some of that with our music, of how in touch with the fans we really are in our music, because we're probably the only genre that does this, that we're so in touch with our fans one-on-one.
Yeah.
You know, you go see big rock shows and things like that. They're not like that.
They don't have a connection. They don't have the connection.
No.
There's just
no.
People are too far away, and I don't just mean by distance as far as the seating. There's just not that feeling of a connection.
Yeah.
That's my way of looking at it.
Right, yeah. I mean, I remember as a kid, again, if it weren't for that connection, I don't know if I would have been the musician that I am or done what I did, because I don't know if I would have had the connection to the – because I remember, like I said, being out in the field, and I heard the music out there that was being played, and I thought, man, that don't sound like what I'm hearing on stage.
Yeah.
I want to be like those guys.
Yeah.
So that's where I started going up to – you know, and a lot of people, you know, talk about it, and I would walk up to Mike Aldridge. I was just a kid. Tom Gray, Ed Ferris.
Wow.
John Duffy.
Oh,
and Duffy – everybody thought Duffy was this gruff – and he may have been, but I think John was more shy than he was gruff. And he was always really good to me. I mean, he always was – even as I became an adult and started singing and was a tenor singer, he was always really good to me. And I feel very blessed that I was able to, you know, draw from that wealth of knowledge. And he was always good to me, man. I mean, all those guys. I mean, I grew up in the shadow of the Seldom Seen and the Country Gentleman.
Yep, you're right there.
They were right here.
Yep, they were right
there. You know, and I could see them anytime I wanted, and it was great. And probably, like I said, if I didn't have those connection of those guys spending minutes with me, you know, maybe there was time they probably didn't feel like it or whatever else, but they always did.
It stays with you. It stays with you, and your experience with Doyle always will. And Darren, I appreciate your time, man. Darren Beachley, first time, but we're gonna talk again when this album comes out. We'll find a way to get back in and run through some more. But for now, we started off this part of the program with the new Ballard Branch. We're going to play the heck out of that while we've got it available.
I appreciate
new single, When Forever Man comes out, I'll get that and I'll stick that in when the whole thing drops. Hopefully you and I can talk again.
We'll do it for sure, absolutely. Right. And I appreciate you, Steve, for doing it.
All right. Hey, Darren, I'll let you go. I'll catch you on the road later.
Take care.
All right. Bye.